The Football Show on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, the greatest football partnership since Jeff and Heskey.
I'm prepared to anything I can.
Well,
to
do it then.
Again.
Do it then.
What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should there be an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
All right, you're welcome along to the Football Show. Nathan and Dan in studio this evening. How are you?
I'm good, Nathan, very good.
Great stuff in the Irish Independent this morning.
Oh, yeah.
Newspapers flying.
Yeah, you know, like words.
I read it.
I did, that's
new
good.
New CEO for the FAI.
An interim CEO, possibly, yeah. It's definitely very much on the agenda, it seems.
Now, I should admit, I didn't actually buy it. I was in Dundrum and I went to Easton's and I stood there and I read it.
Yeah, that's nice, yeah.
My daughter was asleep in the buggy, so I was having a bit of me time. Standing, going through all the newspapers without buying any of them.
Do you ever go into a pub, sort of like sip someone else's pint and walk out?
That would just be rude.
Yeah, wouldn't it? Yeah, you know, or just yeah. You know, just follow the sit, go into a restaurant, sit and
check
maybe order something. Maybe like take take the bread that comes and then just leave before.
Well, they shouldn't just put them at the door where they're so easily accessible.
No, it's true.
They've changed that actually.
Even journalists do that. You pretend you're on the holidays or something, but you're sort of like, oh, quick look.
I think in a lot of the Easton stores that they have moved the newspapers to closer to right inside the store.
Yeah.
And in W.H. Smith as well.
So you have to feel
so you have to go through the store.
And there's an element then of guilt involved where you have to do it in a more public place.
Not for me, obviously.
Well, obviously not for you. I mean,
it is awkward, like, standing there for half an hour reading all the newspapers with a buggy with you as well, and you're blocking the genuine people who want to buy the newspaper.
Especially when you're taking out the supplements.
Got the examiner out, it's like, bloody hell.
Yeah, this is, you know, this is trying hard to be conspicuous here.
Yeah.
But it's still, I mean...
So, like, it's a step up from yesterday, at least.
It is true,
By the weekend, I'll be buying the paper at the weekend.
That, you know, who knows? Who knows? Like, you know, John Malloy every Sunday comes in and reads the ones here.
But he does, they're all delivered.
They're all delivered, yeah.
I love it when I'm in here on a Sunday. Suddenly you've got all the newspapers for free.
I know.
Because Sunday I'm up early buying the newspaper.
Well, that's to say, you're...
Are you using my online subscription?
Yeah, you're listening.
I'm all over it.
See, there's a much more conciliatory tone in our discussions today. You know, I'm enjoying that, you know, after yesterday's tension. Well,
those legal letters will go a long way.
Yeah, they will.
So,
anyway.
We are going to talk about Manchester United, Liverpool, or Liverpool, Manchester United. It is live and off the ball this Sunday from 4:30. Mark Lawrenson is going to join us. He was very much at a time when Liverpool ruled the roost. He's trying to go through classic Liverpool, Manchester United of the Lawrenson era. 85 Cup semi-final, probably as good as it got.
Really? Slightly before my time now, I have to say.
Winner of a replay, Manchester United won. It was a United team with Paul McGrath, Norman Whiteside, Frank Stapleton, Kevin Moran.
Did they play in an FA Cup final in the late 70s?
Late 70s, yeah.
Probably before Mark Lawrenson would have been at Liverpool, right?
So. Or started, what, 81?
Yeah. So, like, yeah, it wouldn't have been a huge amount of heavyweight clashes, I suppose. It was the Liverpool-Everton era, really, was Lawrenson's time, wasn't it? You know, in terms
of
the heavyweight games would have been then.
So he's coming up in just a little while. Your story, though, we should touch on that, actually.
Well, yes.
Another interim CEO. So Paul Cook, who's there at the moment, isn't actually the interim CEO.
He's the executive lead.
Okay.
It's something that's been mentioned in discussions as something the FAI are looking at doing. And it may not happen, but the it certainly seems to be a move towards it. The logic would be that, I mean, in an ideal world, without having this sort of ongoing sort of banks crisis talks to try and protect the FAI's future, in an ideal world, you would be looking to the appointment of the new independent director. Their main job almost is to get together and hire a new CEO. I mean, it is almost a year since John Delaney left the position of CEO to, of course, become executive vice president. But from that point onwards, the CEO post has been filled by someone on an interim basis rather than someone who's, again, like who has that role of actually just driving the association on a number of levels. Like, you have independent directors now, but they actually have jobs, but sort of decent companies and stuff, so they're still doing FAI stuff around other things. So I think, Paul Cook, I think, seems to be very well regarded for what he's done, but there's a lot to do, there's a lot going on. Like, even this week, I mean, there's things going on with, so is the FAI in Limerick, Shamrock Rovers B, and all the other football matters that naturally go on in the course of an association. But from what I can gather, you know, there's obviously board meetings and stuff like that where they can only really focus on the immediacy of getting security about the staff's future, getting wages paid, all this stuff. So,
is there also a sense that obviously they couldn't appoint a new full-time CEO until the independent directors had been appointed. But actually, now that the independent directors have come in, they've probably been actually able to give a realistic time frame, which is, so we need to advertise this.
Yeah.
May take 3 months start to finish as we outline exactly what the role is, we get the applications in, and then we're probably, if you're looking for the calibre, and I'm sure the salary probably still needs to be worked out, but if you're looking for a very high calibre person, they're going to have to leave a previous job and you're probably talking 6 months' notice. So you could still well be the end of this year before the FAI is a permanent CEO.
Well, exactly. Now, it's possible that there may be people that are in the frame that may not necessarily be working at the moment or may have a more favourable situation. Mm. But yes, you are right. You have to go through a process. You have to be seen to do the process right as well. And while people are enthused by the calibre of the independent directors on the board, they're meant to be there as a sort of a responsible, background figures, to steer strategy. But on a day-to-day basis, something we spoke about the FAI before, and it's very important to mention, it's the day-to-day culture. And this is the problem. While the FAI board and the council and all the people have to accept their share of the blame and everything for what went on, naturally, day to day, it was staff that were there who were following orders, but they've been used to doing things a particular way for a particular period of time. So, you do need fresh blood working in the building day to day who can drive strategy and just provide a focus and provide leadership there. And Paul Cook's been thrown in there to try and do that, but I mean, this is almost an unprecedented crisis, and it's been impossible, I think, to manage everything on all levels. So they're going to have to look at some kind of solution. Of course, they were going to with John Foley again until he decided against it at the last minute. And Foley, Paul Cook was actually vice president and then switched over to this role again in a very last minute emergency. So they're going to have to devise some kind of strategy, as you say, until a new person is ready to take over.
Some of the other stories happening today. A story coming from Scotland that the SFA are finalising plans to ban children from under the age of 12 from heading a football, and it could be introduced within the next few weeks.
Yeah, I do find this a very interesting subject, while wondering where does this actually go now, because it already exists in America that heading is banned at sort of a underage, low underage level. But for Scotland to do it, a real traditional football country, highest attendances per capita in Europe, real sort of a place where rugby's not a player really as such, it's a fringe activity, and football is the biggest show in town. So if a country with this sort of football stature is willing to go this way, it's going to put the squeeze on others to follow suit and set the example. I mean, what we've seen in the last 12 to 18 months is more advanced studies and proof of this, that there is a correlation here. We've seen it in other sports. People have been aware of the concussion movie and then there was cases such as Jeff Assel and his family and the points they were able to raise. But there's been more detailed analysis, put out over a long period of time. There was research before Christmas, because I know there's an Irish company, just ex-League of Ireland players, Mark Carrick.
Yeah, Mark Carrick was in studio actually last year talking about this.
Head Right Sports,
where they have a frame basically that's specifically designed, I think, to improve the timing of headers, but also it's a softer ball.
Yeah.
So you're improving your technique, so when you do head the ball, you head it with the right part of your forehead. But also, you're able to practice and practice and practice without it being that big leather football.
Yeah, exactly. And I think I can't remember who did the research before Christmas, but the research before Christmas, was quite stark in terms of the picture it painted. And I spoke to Derek Collin at the time, who's with Mark Carrick, and did point out that this study, it wasn't broken down by position. So it was a sort of a sample of X amount of footballers.
Right.
So the point would be that actually, statistically, if you're a centre half, then or a striker, a position on the pitch that you're
right backs.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
They might bring the mean down. So, for players in that particular area of the pitch, I mean, it's not that long ago since Kevin Doyle, effectively, his career ended due to sort of you know, head injury related issues, or I think, I don't want to sort of get it wrong, but that was ultimately, he was feeling pains, wasn't he? And he was struggling badly at the end. So, I mean, people have to address this, and I do think that, like
are we heading to a situation in 20 years' time where there'll be no heading of the football?
I don't think so. No, I don't think so. Like, as would be pointed out by people, that actually a lot of it is in practice, in training, and maybe on the way up. Now, the one thing you would say is that if you take it out of the game for under-12s and you haven't headed the ball at all in a competitive setting until you're 12, 13, it's probably going to naturally take the skill out of the game a bit, isn't it? You know, like people are going to be used, kids are going to be used to playing in a particular way. They're going to keep the ball on the deck a bit
so
more.
So you'd have a natural reduction in the amount of times people need to head the ball because they'd have grown up
possibly
playing a different style of football.
Possibly. You know, possibly. I mean, I'm sure they're still going to play with their mates. They're still going to be watching football on telly where adults are heading the ball. But
I'm trying to think of that in practice. But actually, would you end up with almost the opposite? Because surely the advice, if you're playing at underage level and nobody can head the ball, is that you kick it high. You try and go over people's heads.
Yeah, it's true, actually. I must actually look up and see these games in the States. How do they actually handle it?
Enda's not convinced.
Yeah.
But surely that's the obvious thing. You aim high.
There is a certain logic to that, but
can
I mean...
kick the ball that high? Yeah, kids can kick the ball that high.
Yeah, but they definitely can, but like, do they just put their hand up for a cynical professional foul all the time just to stop the ball if it's going over the head and they can't head it? Like, I'd love to know...
You're going to have, what, six-a-side games?
Yeah, this is it, you know? But like,
has anybody thought about this?
No,
I'm sure they have.
Okay, maybe this isn't like the serious issue at heart here. But like, if it does become a thing where, I don't know, I don't think you can ever take it out of the game. You would think that it's almost like it's the technology of the ball and the what people use in training and the frequency in training. Because again, that's the point. It's if you know how many times a week. Okay, we're talking in terms of maybe full-time footballers as opposed to kids, but how many times a week would a footballer head the ball? You know, if you take it out of training or you change the device you use in training, then naturally you're reducing the risk by percentage. Yeah, but then it's the aerial collisions and stuff too, as opposed to just actually the amount of times that you head it. So, but it's not stopping, you know, and the evidence is there, and you know people are quite conscious now of health and a variety under a variety of headings. So there's going to be a serious pressure because we're lucky we haven't had too many flashpoint cases in football. We're only learning more now. We are now learning more. I'm starting to think more about maybe people, and I hate to talk in these terms, but people who passed away in the past, and people never really imagined that this relationship could be there, and now they're suddenly wondering, oh, well, maybe.
Well, that's why I do wonder where we'll be in 20 years' time as that generation of 50 and 60 year olds that are coming through now, that we are more aware and that people know this is happening and you can test and you can discover this as to will this sort of decision by the SFA be replicated elsewhere but also go to a higher age level.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the English FA's point is they've no plans to change their position. The heading is safe. They argue no evidence to suggest heading in youth football would be more of a risk than at other stages. Heading is actually significantly less common in children's games, they said. Our analysis shows, on average, there's only around 1.5 headers per game in youth football. But
maybe what the SFA are doing is trying to introduce it at a young age, as you say, so that as they continue up the ranks,
it doesn't become. It's not a big part. As big a part of your makeup, you know. You will need to have a good touch for a big man.
Yeah, you're dead right. Head Right Sports is the company that Mark Herrick had. He was in last year. You can check that out online, but check out the website as well. Very much ahead of their time. Ahead of their time. See what I did there?
Yeah, it was average.
Wouldn't put it in the paper, no?
No. It must have.
Fair enough. Manchester United. So there's a bit going on at Manchester United ahead of their trip to Anfield on Sunday. Last night we were watching the game against Wolves. Marcus Rashford went off. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has admitted it backfired. Initially there was it's burnout, but it seems this was actually more of an impact injury.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what just happened.
Yeah.
But going to Anfield without Marcus Rashford, who scored the last time that they played Liverpool, it's very hard to see Manchester United winning this game. They're 7-1.
Very hard to see it. Maybe at least there's a sort of an excuse of sorts there anyway. You know, if things go badly wrong, it's like, well, we had Rashford available. Maybe things might have been different.
This Bruno Fernandes deal is still rumbling on. It'd be very, very new Manchester United, Ed Woodward, if this actually didn't happen in the end. The latest is that he has agreed personal terms, but he is going to play tomorrow night, it seems. They're playing Benfica in the Lisbon derby. He's with Sporting Lisbon, and Sporting want Bruno Fernandes to play in that game. What could possibly go wrong?
This will add to the story. Yeah, and Jorge Mendes involved. Pointed out he was in the director's box for the game against Wolves, but he's so close to Wolves, he's probably at a lot of Wolves games. You know,
United hoping for a fee of around 50 million. Sporting looking for closer to 70, but it'll probably end up being a little bit closer to 50. Is he the answer?
I don't know. I haven't seen enough to be able to definitively say that.
And I've seen quite a bit of him for Sporting Lisbon in the Europa League, and again, it's difficult to judge because they're pretty much a one-man team.
Yeah.
So they had this crisis a couple of years ago where 6-7 of the players cancelled their contracts. I think Rui Patricio was
among them.
And they ended up leaving the club.
Supporters were attacking them in the car park, and there was a few other things going on, wasn't there? Was that
Yeah, there was a breakdown with the ownership who didn't support them. So, yeah, and they were attacked by supporters and they decided to leave. But he stayed. And watching them in the Europa League, he pulls the strings. Absolutely. He's at the centre of everything. And maybe that's what he is at Manchester United. Maybe that's exactly what they need. Somebody who's there demanding the ball constantly. Like, it's never really happened for him at international level yet. He's sort of playing him as... Like, he's sort of where you'd think... Like, last season he scored a ridiculous amount of goals for Sporting Lisbon. So you would think he could play in that more advanced position. But I presume United want him a bit deeper.
Yeah. I don't know. You just wonder... Like, is the problem so deep-seated there? Like, can one player just go in and have a transformative effect? I mean, we've seen big players go for big money moves or well-touted moves in recent years and sort of just get stuck in the quagmire. You know?
Manchester United way, as it is now.
Well, that's what it's now called. So you'd be loath to declare anything. You know, it's generally hard, I think, in January as well for someone to come in and have that type of impact. You know, it's actually quite unusual that you would have a high-calibre move take place in January. You know, the summer is the perfect time. You have that pre-season excitement, that time away. I mean, if the mood is not great there at the moment, I mean, it's pretty obvious that it's probably not, and that someone comes in and they're thrown into it, and then, you know, there's a risk attached with that. But you would think, though, in January as well, that, I mean, obviously there's reasons why, you know, there might be a certain pressure to sell now. You know, they've got financial problems, so you can get away with it a bit more. But generally, the club in January has to pay over the odds because it's desperation that they're so desperate to bring in a player then.
It does look like, from his point of view, a risky time to go in that. So ideal scenario is he goes, he shows some promise, and then he's got his taste of the Premier League and gets a full pre-season and is very much running the show in that United midfield come to start of next season. But it's hard right now to see things getting much better at Manchester United between now and the end of the season. And he's suddenly stuck right in the middle of that. Question marks been asked everywhere. And rather than going into pre-season buzzing, it's, well, this guy, we know he isn't the answer. Didn't show anything for the last 3 or 4 months.
Yeah. Do you reckon Manchester United would let potential future managers know that this deal is in the offing, and what might they think of it?
You wondering, have they been in touch with Mauricio Pochettino's agent to say, would you approve of such a deal? Well, they have been linked with Spurs. He's one of those players, in a way that shows the interest, like the level United have gone to.
Yeah.
These players that are on this sort of European merry-go-round of they're linked with Tottenham, they're linked with Wolves, and now they go to Manchester United. Like, they sort of were at a different level.
Yeah, but also, I suppose if you're a player, you would want to know that, wouldn't you? The player's probably entitled to say, you know, nice to meet you, but I'm hearing a few things about what might be going on. You know, he's not going to say
that.
Of course, he wouldn't say it to the manager, but you'd say it to
the agent.
To the agent, to the representative, just in case. You know, because what if someone comes in and you're completely not their cup of tea at all?
All right, well, that is Liverpool against Manchester United. He won't be playing this weekend, obviously, for Manchester United. It is live and off the ball. We're going to look ahead to the game with Mark Lawrenson in just a moment.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. The greatest football partnership since Shearer and Owen.
Welcome back to Thursday's football show. Nathan and Dan still in studio. We're going to talk Liverpool, Manchester United in just a moment. But it is Oscar season. So there's only one man we can talk to. The voice of the BBC. How he never got his opportunity to present the film show, I'll never understand.
Robbed.
Mark Lawrenson, good evening.
Good evening, guys.
Have you seen many of the contenders?
No, the only one I've seen is 1917.
Any good?
Yes. Fantastically filmed. I'm sure you're aware, it was just... They shoot the cameras, followed these two army boys around all the time. the story was quite sort of obvious, but I think the fact because it was a new way of actually making a film, we'd get loads of plaudits for that. It was very, very good, but I didn't think it was like, wow.
So you don't think it's going to get the best picture?
Well, my better half, Kathy, right, she went to see J.J. Rabbit, Jojo Rabbit.
Jojo Rabbit.
She's here now, and she said it's brilliant.
Does she want to give a more in-depth review?
Well, she probably would, and she'd probably be better than me, former school teacher, but she can get on with making the tea. No, I'm only joking.
She can give you a smack for that. Have you not seen The Irishman yet?
Oh, sorry, I have seen The Irishman. Yeah, of course I did, because Pacino's my big... I love Pacino. It was good. It was obviously a really slow burner. I mean, just after 20 minutes, you're one of those thinking, well, where's this going? And you suddenly realise it's over 3 hours. But if you stick with it, I would say I preferred The Irishman actually more than 2017. But then, and it's 2019, she's shouting at me.
1917.
I know, I'm having one, not even had a drink. And but no, because as I say, Pacino, De Niro, Joe Pesci as well, brilliant.
Have you seen any of them, Dan?
No, I haven't seen that. I haven't been to the cinema in a year or so. But apparently you haven't been in years.
That's me? Yeah. I haven't been in, I would say... No, I've been to kids' movies.
Oh, okay.
Lots and lots of kids' movies in recent years.
That's a bit of a worry.
Well, I was there my children. Dear God. I think we're going to have to move on. I did see Marriage Story because it was on Netflix. Very good.
Yeah, no.
Scarlett Johansson, excellent.
No,
listen, guys, The Irishman, that came out on Netflix.
That's on Netflix as well. I haven't dedicated the full 3.5 hours to it yet.
Yeah, now Shane Ed in the office loves 1917. He'll be distraught to hear now that Laro's given it a somewhat 5 out of 10, 6 out of 10 type review.
No, I'll give it 7. But if you're going to win the big prize, you've got to be 9. Have you?
That's fair enough.
You very much do. I think we should move on because, well, that went down a path that wasn't doing any of us any favors, right?
particularly you, Nathan. To be fair,
we're going to be at Anfield on Sunday for Liverpool against Manchester United. Before we get into the current crop of Liverpool and Manchester United players, we were just looking back through your career, Mark, and trying to figure out the memorable Liverpool-Manchester United games, and it was obviously a time where Liverpool were totally dominant and United quite weren't quite at that level where Everton was the real rivalry. But the one that stands out, I think, was the 85 semi-final that went to a replay, and like anything you read about it, particularly that first game, was it Goodison Park and the atmosphere and the hatred that seemed to be there between the two sets of supporters?
Yeah, no, it wasn't a good atmosphere to play in. I mean, the fact it was at Goodison wasn't great for us. And in all honesty, guys, I think we scraped a 2-2, did we not?
Yeah, late equaliser in 90 minutes, late equaliser in injury time.
Paul Walsh, maybe, I would have thought, might have scored one of the goals at Walshy.
He did, he scored deep in injury time. Ronnie Whelan as well.
Oh, Ronnie, okay. But in that game and also the subsequent replay, I think, didn't we go one up in the replay, Graeme Sinesco, no? Or Stevie Nicol?
I think there might have been an own goal.
I think for Stevie Nicol. Anyway, but Robbo scored, didn't he? I think Robbo scored. Brian Robson scored the winner. They were better than us in both games. Sometimes you just hold your head up. I think we thought after snatching a draw, we couldn't play as bad. Well, guess what? Yeah. We did.
Yeah, it was a Paul McGrath own goal in the second game.
You were dead right to blank it out.
Yeah.
That's a collector's item.
Because I was just reading here in a piece looking back that time, Mark, that Ron Atkinson was a figure of hate for the Liverpool fans. Was there any particular reason that springs to mind, or he was just had he sort of wound people up at some point?
No, I don't think so. And to be fair to Ron actually loved Liverpool. Mm. He was whenever you met him, even long about that time privately, he absolutely loved what they did, what they stood for, etc. I'm pretty sure when also in those years, United came to Anfield to play, and as they got off the bus, somebody, one of our stupid supporters, sprayed them with like some kind of tear gas or something.
Right.
And of course, we're sat in the dressing room and think, oh my God, of all the things you wanted to do against Manchester United, you would not do that. So Norman Whiteside, Remy Moses, Brian Robbo, I mean, they kicked lumps out of us, absolutely lumps out of us. I think we might have drawn, but it was just, it was a game for half an hour where the ball wasn't needed.
That, I think, was that the only season you actually didn't win a trophy with Liverpool?
Yeah, quite possibly. I mean, I can't remember last Wednesday, so I wouldn't really know. But as you know, with the film 2017, not. But yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, it's funny because my first 3 years won the league, 3 years running, and I have to tell you, my kid's life, I never really realised because it was just kind of won loads of stuff. And I know it sounds very blasé, but it was also it became like a business as much as anything.
Well, was it Jim McConnelly after Dublin won the four in a row or the five in a row where he was telling one of his teammates he was seeing on pitch saying, that's my fifth, and they were going, no, that's your sixth.
Yeah.
All-Ireland title. When you have that level of success.
Good problem to have, I think, to be fair.
Great problem to have. Yeah. Yeah.
So a season like that then, when you actually don't win something, does that not stand out?
Yeah, but it stands out that much that they can't remember it. Listen, what they used to do, you've heard about, used to come at the start of the season and with the league winners' medals and Ronnie Moran would come around the dressing room and we played 42 games in the league then. So if you played 14, you got a medal and he'd literally go around the dressing room and say to lads, how many games did you play? Obviously, once you got past 14 plus, you got a medal. And if you said, oh, 13, Ronnie went, unlucky. And he moved on to the next person, and that's the way that it was. And also, I think they would come at the start of the season, the boot room, and when they were questioned at the start of the season about, oh, you know, what competition would you like to win, they'd go mad. And they'd just go to the questioner and go, you know what, we'll take any competition. We can't. We don't think we're good enough that we can actually say we want to win this year. And that's just the way that they were.
What level were that United team at? Because obviously there was a huge Irish interest in that Manchester United team when you had Kevin Moore, and Frank Stapleton, Paul McGrath, Norman Whiteside was in there as well. Was that a team that should have achieved more?
I think possibly. I think we just had the edge on them. I mean, as you know, I mean, I nearly went to Man United because when Ron got the job, and Ron had called me knowing that I'd spoken to Arsenal, was about to speak to Liverpool. And Ron just said, look, I want to take you. And I was obviously being told from Brighton, he said, I want to take, I want to give Brighton two or three players from Man United and some money for you. He said, I'll tell you now, I'll give you better wages than Liverpool are going to give you. But the main problem for me was that Frank Stapleton was going on like a Bosman. But it was going to tribunal. And Ron said to me, look, Mark, he said, I'll have to wait a little while because we don't know how much we're going to have to pay for Frank. And I said, look, Ron, you know, I'm just going to go and sign for Liverpool. And he turned around and says, yeah, well, I don't blame you, to be fair. but Brian Robson, imagine Brian Robson playing now. Because he could just do anything, absolutely anything. Scored goals, he tackled he was a frightening tackler, fantastic motivator, got up and down the pitch all the time. And you know, when you talk about leaders and you talk about Man United and you talk about the kings of this world, and quite rightly so, and maybe Steve Bruce, but Brian Robson was just an absolute outstanding footballer.
I don't remember a huge amount of Brian Robson playing, but like everything you hear is always about the energy and getting up and down the pitch.
Yeah.
Is there a player now that it's possible to compare Robson to?
No. Only because, guys, I think also, obviously, you could assault and battery someone, couldn't you? And Robbo would also do that on a regular basis when it was needed. If you were fighting, he'd be up there at the front. So, no, and I think it's very, very difficult because of that, because of the physicality of the 80s, certainly, to compare nowadays, because, as we know, you can't really tackle, can you?
So looking at this Sunday then, Liverpool obviously running away with the Premier League title, 20 wins and one draw from their opening 20 games. They start this match 27 points clear of Manchester United back in fifth. Like, I don't think there's ever been a bigger gap between the two teams. Manchester United have frustrated the life out of Liverpool over the last 3 or 4 years. Is that just the way United have set up, or do you think at this stage there's maybe something mental for these Liverpool players that while they can go and they can beat Manchester City, Tottenham, Arsenal, Chelsea, there's something about United that just makes them a little bit more nervous?
Well, there could be. You could argue, though, that last season when Liverpool went to Old Trafford, that for one of the very rare occasions, Klopp got it wrong. He went a little bit kind of protective of the team as much as anything, and never really, as we've seen this season, it's just what we go for the jugular, whichever team it is. And I think, as I say, that was one of the few mistakes that he made. I think once you see Sunday, I mean, once the game starts, Liverpool will just absolutely, totally go for the jugular, because that's the way that they play. And also, we know with Manchester United as well, you're not sure from game to game which side's going to turn up, one that can look very good on occasions and one that can look extremely ordinary. I mean, I've not seen the papers today. Is Rashford looking like he's going to be fit?
I'd say it's very much touch and go, 50-50 at best for United.
OK. Well, that would make a great difference, because what United do have, I mean, if you play the regular front three, or what you would consider the front three, they've got fantastic pace. And if they just sit in and look to try and play on the break, that would be a little bit of a problem for Liverpool. But I just don't look at Manchester United across the midfield and think they could possibly dominate the game. And, you know, with Liverpool, while the midfield players aren't spectacular, they're all 8.5, 9 out of 10 every single week, and they cover an unbelievable amount of ground. And, you know, it's the way that the team's set up. I mean, they get the width from the full-backs, as everybody knows. But the three lads up front are just outstanding. And, you know, everyone goes on about Mane, quite rightly, of course, and Salah. But for me, Firmino has been the one in the last few weeks, because he's the glue. And he's the one who plays his kind of false number nine, but he's brilliant at it. And he just gets himself into pockets of spaces where he gets a ball down and he brings the other two guys into play. And I just think with the three of them, they work so hard together. And, you know, they're not really bothered, apart from maybe Mo Salah a little bit, but who actually scores the goals. I think that's a good thing about Bobby, and also Mane as well, because he's such a good player, and he's such a strong player as well.
I think most people now acknowledge everything that Firmino does to help that front three and make them click.
Yeah.
At home at Anfield, he's really struggled for goals over the last sort of 8-9 months. Does he play a different role in the home games than he does away?
Yeah, a little bit. And of course, you know, of course, the thing about that would be that, and quite a natural thing, is that when Liverpool play at home, generally they're pushing the opposition back. So there's probably not as many holes for him to kind of find and get into. Whereas obviously away from home generally, you know, teams are a little bit more adventurous against Liverpool. Not massively, but a little bit more. And that's all he needs. He only needs half a yard of space. So that's, you know, it was like that Peter Beardsley. Peter Beardsley was exactly like that, insofar as away from home, he got more room and he would like destroy teams. And at home, more often than not, you know, I remember the boot room guy saying, look, he ain't quite the same player at home because he just didn't have as much room to play in.
Liverpool, and you talk about the games against Manchester United, like last season at Anfield, Liverpool ripped United apart. They beat them 3-1. It probably could have been much, much more. But Jose, in his time, we'd end up talking about a Jose masterclass. They would sit deep. And Liverpool, for a long period, struggled against those sort of teams who just sat deep and tried to get them under counter-attack. And like, I think the game against Sheffield United recently, where Liverpool set a new record for the number of passes, they just totally dominated the game. Have you seen a change in how they deal with those sort of teams? Is it a patience? Is it a mental thing? Or has Klopp changed the style of play that they can break them down a bit better?
Well, I just think it's the ability of the players. And when you look at it, as I say, we've just waxed lyrical about the front three, but what about the two fullbacks? I mean, are there a better pair of fullbacks in Europe? No. World football, I wouldn't have thought so. I mean, these two lads are just absolutely fabulous, and everybody knows about the way that they play, that you know, certainly Mane on one side and Salah on the other side, they come in and make it narrow so the fullbacks give them all the width. But every single team just really struggles to deal with them. And when you look at Liverpool, because, you know, the Van Dijk fella is such a good player, sometimes he even leaves two against two at the back and they just take the chances. And consequently, they just flood the midfield with the fullbacks getting forward. The three lads, whoever they are, you know, normally Henderson, Wijnaldum, you know, and the others can change Lallana or obviously Milner when he's fit, Keita, etc., Sir Fabinho. But they basically are the engine room and they work extremely hard. I mean, they cover so many yards. And if you ask the back players, especially the fullbacks, about the midfield players, they absolutely love them, because they basically fill in the holes as well, because some of those that I've just mentioned aren't really attacking midfield players. And he just got the team set up brilliantly. I think that's the thing when you watch it. And he doesn't change his tactics against anybody. He thinks that they can beat anybody. And he's just got a great bunch of guys. And I mean, you know, in the dressing room. I mean, I go quite often, and I work a bit for the football club, for the TV and stuff, and the stories you get from the dressing room are always unbelievably positive, just about the manager and all the players. There's nobody which has been left out of the team that, you know, says the manager's crap, goes and knocks on his door. He just doesn't have that because they absolutely love him.
I mean, Mark, we've reached a sort of strange point of the season where pretty much everyone sort of acknowledges that the league is over, but you can't really be seen to say it naturally, and there's a professionalism there, and Liverpool are relentless and they keep doing it. But, I mean, do you think it's possible for them to sustain this all the way to the end of the season, or is it natural that at some stage, you know, that realisation really sets in that it's done, and then you lose some intensity when that happens?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think they'll win it early. That's the first thing. I mean, I think City have got the mojo back. I think they'll win an awful lot of games. But I do think that Liverpool will win it early. And quite possibly, that there will be a dropping off if they win it, say they won it, I don't know, start of April, middle of April. There will be a dropping off. And who's to say that they're not involved in the Champions League semi-finals and ultimately the finals? So, yeah, the manager will change it, I would think, on many different occasions, trying to save the legs of his players. But I certainly remember one year where we won it probably late March, early April, 7 games before the end, and we never won a game. I think we probably drew about 3 or 4 and lost 3 or 4. So it won't really matter, and that's why everybody keeps going on to the manager about the record. He really seriously is not bothered about the record. He said that in 5 years' time, if we've broken a record this year, so I look at it and think, oh, that wasn't bad. But he's just not that way inclined at all.
If you were in Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's shoes heading into Sunday, what would you do? How would you set your side up?
Well, I'd realise that constipation was cured when you turn up on Sunday. Most definitely. I think, you know, whatever you think about Ole Gunnar Solskjaer...
Sorry, what does that even mean?
You really don't know?
Think about it.
I was wondering what that would have meant. I'll just go with it, okay.
So whatever way he sets up his team, he can't go gung-ho, you know, because he knows if he gets done 3, 4 or 5 at the weekend, you know, his job is even more serious on the line than it already is. So I think he's just going to kind of circle the wagons and try and play on the break, which obviously Rashford would be the key, along with Martial, etc. So, but when you look at United, you just, you know, I said to you before about the midfield, I'm not sure that, you know, even the setup with a 4-3-3 and the 3 in the middle literally stay in the middle and just don't get pulled out. I mean, who's going to deal with the flying fullbacks? I just don't really see it, to be honest with you, at all.
Do you see any similarities between where Manchester United are now, say 5, 6 years on from Alex Ferguson, to where Liverpool would have been mid-90s after Kenny Dalglish left the club?
Yeah. Well, you know, you can... absolutely. But also, what about if you go even further back with Manchester United? Because when Busby left, it took them an awful lot of managers before they turned up with Sir Alex. You know, now obviously since Sir Alex, they've had, what is it, the fourth or fifth? It's probably the fourth, is he?
Yeah.
Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. So, well, that's the problem. I mean, when you create this dynasty, and then more often than not, it's very, very difficult to kind of keep the dynasty going. It's and then you're looking at kind of people at your football club who are head of recruitment, who have been there for years, who stay on and still recruit. And, you know, when people talk about teams now and everything, and, you know, yeah, the manager's absolutely unbelievably important. I think almost as big a job at any football club is recruitment. Because if you don't get that right at the very, very top and you drop off 5 or 10%, you don't win leagues anymore.
Mark, great stuff. We'll let you go.
Pleasure.
Go enjoy your tea, which is being made right now, I hope, to a very high standard.
9 out of 10 standard, you would assume.
Well, of course.
Of course, yeah.
So this is live 4:30 Sunday.
Are you going or who's
I am going.
Oh, yeah.
I shall be there.
You always take those things, don't you?
Look at the draw.
I'd say it was one of those draws, all right. Why is there only one? Why is there only one?
Not unusual for the person who runs the raffle to win the raffle.
Yeah, it's always a coincidence,
you
know.
It was for a long time, obviously, the number one game on your list.
Yeah.
But obviously, I've been to Liverpool Manchester United quite a few times over the last few years, and
often disappoints you.
More often than not, it ends up disappointing.
So like, you have to work off that whole reverse psychology to don't look forward to this one at all. Expect as little as possible, and then it might be that surprise.
Will it tarnish Liverpool's league title if they end the season with 36 wins and the only two they didn't were against Manchester United?
It'll be a very, very small, if that's small victory for
that Manchester. Kind of is the level Manchester United
if that's the joy they can take, that says it says more about them than anyone else.
Only it is Manchester United. You can't really, on paper, give Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's side chance.
You're looking at sort of variables that even mean anything, like does a crest or a shirt, you know, really cause a team who's sort of beaten all before them to suddenly lose their way? I mean, of course
they showed,
it can happen.
They showed
of course there's loads of examples that can happen.
Even the one-all draw earlier in the season, I think it was Andreas Pereira, he played in a more advanced role, and like, I haven't seen him play like that since. There was an energy, a sort of passion to him that we haven't seen. Now, he hasn't been able to sustain it, really. But they can turn up, and they've shown consistently this season United, they can turn up on the day. It'll be interesting from a Liverpool point of view if they can get to the level, like, or if there is some sort of a mental block, that the one little bit of pressure they feel all season is when they face Manchester United.
Yeah, no, I guess so. But I mean, you do have this line about, you know, form going out the window. But I think you reach a stage where form levels out over a period of time, and eventually it comes true. It sees itself out. I mean, I think you might have that one performance in you. It's hard to see it. Has been repeated. Like, I just wonder though, I mean, Liverpool, it's such a relentless burst. I know we spoke about it briefly there, that at some point you'd imagine, and maybe if you want to peak later on the season for Europe, which is going to be another, you actually fear that lull where the league is won really early, and then you're in this weird trying to get yourself up for one game.
Do you play your full team on a Saturday when you want them fully fit on Wednesday, and they're going into a Champions League semi-final, haven't played together in 3 or 4 weeks?
But it's just strange. It's the inverse of last year, where you wondered, well, was losing the league or was the intensity of the league race going to cost them in Europe? But it actually didn't. It kept them competitive all the way, and it brought them right to it, even if the final wasn't very good. But actually now it'd be a slightly different challenge. The league's done, and if Liverpool are still in Europe at that point, can they suddenly just drop off and then lift themselves? You know, that's going to be
Because the obsession with Liverpool is obviously around going and being invincible, like that Arsenal side, where actually the more likely record for them is that they'll probably win the league title earlier than any other side has ever done. And then to sustain it, like as Mark talked about there when he was playing, like if the title's won with 8 games to go, it's almost impossible to see Liverpool going unbeaten in those last 8 games.
I think
you can sustain
it. Would you rather have that invincible record or like do a double? You know, as in do a, I mean, a league Champions League double.
Ah, league Champions League double.
You know, that's the one. So, you know, when it comes to it, you may have to, that sacrifice may have to be made. You know, if you have a Saturday, Tuesday turnaround or whatever it might be for a dangerous fixture against a team with a lot to play for at that stage.
We were talking earlier on with John Giles about Eddie Howe and Bournemouth and the position they find themselves in, second from bottom in the Premier League table. Just a complete collapse. They have a huge amount of injuries. The statistic going around earlier in the week that Callum Wilson hadn't had a shot on target since the beginning of October probably sums it up. Should Eddie Howe be under pressure?
It seems harsh. I did hear someone who would follow that beat a lot more suggesting that maybe if anything was going to happen, that he would resign rather than the club ever actually sacking him. I mean, of course, because the price of relegation is so costly. As much as Bournemouth, little old Bournemouth, I mean, they have Russian ownership, you know, like they do have serious wealth there. But of course he will. And sometimes it's just hard, you know, to just keep going again and again. Where is he on the longest serving list now in the Premier League?
He's
number one. So, like, unfortunately, that says something in itself, you know, to keep, you know, managing it. Every season he's kept them up, it has been an achievement. As much as they've spent money, it still has been an achievement to do it. And
well, that's what I'm wondering.
The voice sometimes after a period of time, it's not one of these ones where you're leaving with your reputation damaged. It's just that the fresh voice is just needed, whatever it might be. I think clubs, when they're in danger of relegation, they'll make a lot of changes. I wonder even with Villa and Dean Smith, if they're struggling with a couple of months ago. He's loved there because he's a Villa fan and stuff, but you know, that sentiment versus going down again.
And the one question mark probably over Eddie Howe is that when Bournemouth have spent big, it's rarely worked out.
Yeah.
You think of what Liverpool have managed to take off Bournemouth over the last few years for Solanke and Ibe, like 30 million quid. Neither of them have done anything.
No, it's true. I mean, a great business from their perspective. And you wonder, you know, is it something about working with that type of player coming out of a particular type of club? They've had the Chelsea loanees and people have gone there, have done okay. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know what it might be. Like, the Bournemouth still had a core there from their promotion team that was around in their first couple of seasons in the Premier League, and Harry Arthur was amongst them. You know, and naturally it's just dwindled a small bit through injury and age and whatever it might be. And maybe you lose something with that. And you've seen that in the past, but teams have come up like Reading and Wolves, and they've had a certain strength there for a couple of years that's part of the dressing room. And Sheffield United are going to have to face it too. You know, like, it catches up with you over a period of time. And it might just be what it is.
All right, good stuff, Dan. Enjoy the weekend.
I will.
Paddy Power and the Football Show. The greatest football partnership since Duff and Heskey.